Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Little do most of us know that we are facing a $9 trillion debt in 2009 here in the United States of America that has a lot of people shaking their heads. What do you mean, $9 trillion debt? How could that be possible? We're going to talk about that and a great deal more this hour. There's a movie now showing at the Charles Theater called IOUSA, and we're going to talk with two of the folks who made that movie possible and also wrote the book, IOUSA, One Nation Under Stress in Debt. We are joined by Addison Wiggin, who is executive producer and writer of the documentary film and executive publisher of Agora Financial, and Kate E. Contrera, who is co-author of IOUSA, One Nation Under Stress in Debt, and associate producer and writer for the documentary film of the same name, IOUSA, and is managing editor of The Daily Reckoning. Welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having us.
410-319-8888 is the number here to call, or join us here at steinershow@gmail.com. 410-319-8888. There are a lot of questions about this. We'll get into it in the course of the hour in terms of why we have this deficit and where it's going and what needs to be done to stop it. And there are very many different ideas about what it means to stop it. I know that Pete Peterson has been one of the people behind the film, and I've been reading a great deal about some people who have very different ideas about what should happen to this debt rather than his idea. But let's talk about some of the fundamentals of what we're talking about here. The book you put out paints a very frightening picture about the state of the American deficit. And I just want to let's play a small clip from this film for a moment. This is a clip, I think, from the young people. This is clip number one, where young people are asked about the debt, and this is their response. Okay, I guess their response was so frightening that they ran off and left, pounding their drums. But we'll see if we can get that working and bring that back. But but the thing is that most people don't realize the state of the debt in America, the state of the national debt. And Addison, if you could just lead off, let's just talk a bit about what that state is. I mean, one of the things the film clearly points out in the beginning is China is first in the world with the largest surplus on the planet Earth among nations, and the United States of America is dead last with the largest deficit.
That specifically refers to the trade deficit, which is one of the deficits that we point out in the film. We actually look at the federal deficit year over year, which this year was a historic for 2008, which ended September 30th of 2008, was a historic $454 billion. And you mentioned $9 trillion at the opening of the show. In the movie, we predicted that by the time the new president was sworn in on January 20th, that it would be somewhere around $10 trillion. But in fact, we were a little off in our projection, and the debt went over $10 trillion on September 30th. So we while we were making the film, the progression and compounding of the national debt increased faster than what we were expecting it to do. So the crisis, as it were, becomes a little bit more poignant even beyond what we've put in the book and in the film. A couple other deficits that we look at which compound the problem are the savings deficit, which in 2005 and 2006, Americans spent more than they took in savings, and they made up the difference using credit card or home equity loans. And the last time we had a back-to-back negative savings rate in the country was 1933 and 1934. Which at the outset of the film project was kind of a remarkable idea to be comparing statistics, economic statistics of today to the Great Depression. Since that time, over the course of building the film, you know, shooting and editing and redirecting the point of the film, comparisons to from this the state of the economy today to the Great Depression have become, you know, almost a daily occurrence. So we've seen a great shift in the mindset of just the general public over the 2.5 years that we've made the film. When we began, it was the height of the housing boom. Most people were counting on the rising value of their homes as kind of their principal asset, and they were feeling wealthy, and they were, you know, they were willing to spend more than they took in. And now a lot of people are much more nervous about the economy, the country's place in the world and their future within it. So they're asking much different questions than they were just 2.5 years ago. And that's really why we made the film. And the last and probably the most poignant deficit that we're looking at is what David Walker, the former Comptroller General of the country, calls the leadership deficit. The difficulty or the inability, really, of elected officials to bring up these issues and address them clearly when or even present solutions that people can understand and begin to vote on or follow. When we began the project, the discussion about the federal deficit, savings deficit, or trade deficit were left to, policy wonks, so to speak, in Washington, and not really understood or discussed among the general public. And that's what we've been trying to do with the film and the book now. The book it's actually doing pretty well on Amazon right now. We're trying to get outside of that policy discussion and educate people on the challenges that are facing the nation.
What do you mean you try to get outside the policy discussion?
Well, we point this out in the film, actually. A lot of people, the clip that we're about to listen to, we did a lot of man on the street question. Everywhere we went that we talked to somebody, we made a point to talk to people on the street as well and find out what they thought about trade deficit or savings deficit or the federal government borrows money, that kind of thing. And became obvious very quickly that most people don't really understand the economy. They don't understand the policy discussions that take place in the papers, for example. And because of that, they think that some expert in Washington or some banker on Wall Street is going to provide the solutions that will take care of the economy. And they effectively abdicate their responsibility for understanding their role within it. So we tried to make a popular piece that would make a lot of these issues accessible and entertaining in a way, because we recognize that in this soundbite and video culture that we live in, we had to produce something that would keep people's attention for long enough to understand difficult issues.
You have to, if things have to be done creatively for people to get their hands around what's going on. And Kate, one of the things that struck me about both the book and the movie is that is the real extent of the debt in America. And when you look at what it means when I think that what you said in the book, both the book and the film, that in the 70s, about 13.5% of the people, 13.5% of our disposable income was in savings. And in this new century, our savings are down to minus 2.93% of disposable income. That's a huge shift. There are all these shifts going on in America in terms of the statistics you showed now and then about how grave the situation is.
Yeah, people just are not saving anymore. We've come into this culture of, you want everything right now. And the American people are paralleling the U.S. government and just, spending and spending and spending and not really saving or thinking about what's coming around the corner or down the line.
We've noticed, too, that during the credit crisis, when the credit market seized up a little bit, and the stock market started going down, September of 2008, the savings rate jumped up to 2.7%. And the government's response is, 70% of the U.S. economy is driven by consumer spending. If consumers begin to spend less, that presents a problem for employment, for example. We just saw Circuit City declare bankruptcy today, and they're going to lay off in part of that bankruptcy filing. They're going to lay off 17% of their workforce, and that's just the latest in a long line of sort of retailers on the front end of the consumer economy showing some nervousness about what's happening when consumers start saving again.
Well, let's talk a bit about that. I mean, talk a bit about what the analysis you have is, and what the analysis of this, both your book and the movie, are about why we're in this, how we got to this point. I mean, I'm a history buff, so when I was looking at the film, and I was, it's when you show the how we were in great debt after the Revolutionary War. It took about 40 years to get rid of that debt. By 1835, we were down to no debt, and then it grew again because of the Civil War and other things in this country. But and even after World War II, when the debt was very high, some people say that debt was probably, you had to have deficit spending during the war, that it was whittled down during the Cold War, even though GDP, I mean, even though the amount of money the government was spending in deficit was not zero, and it was growing. But so there are times when the American government has been in great deficit, and we've whittled away at it. It's taken a long time, though.
Right. I think that that's an important part of what we want to bring up, is that even after World War II, that's probably the most egregious example, because the way most economists measure it, it's a percentage of GDP. So during World War II, the national debt went up to 120% of GDP. But there was a compelling urgency after the war to pay off that debt. There was a recognition that we needed to have deficit spending in order to fight the war, effectively defend our way of life. But following the war, there was an urgency to pay that off. And until about the early 70s, you see it get paid back down on a consistent basis. In the early 80s, we start with this concept of supply-side economics, which is sort of a mutation of Keynesian economics that says that the government's job is to get involved when the economy is slow as well, and deficit spending is considered to be an effective way of rebooting the economy when it gets sluggish. In early 80s, for example, we had a recession, and it was deemed acceptable to spend more than the government had taken in order to.
But that was also the time, though, in the Reagan era, when we started cutting taxes. Spending was going up anyway, even though we were cutting taxes.
Right.
Went on during the Bush administration, and we also decided in that period that that deregulation was important, which some people see as the seeds of the financial crisis that we face today.
Right. And the cutting of taxes is sort of the second part of the supply side idea, which is if you keep taxes at an optimum rate, then the economy will grow and revenues for the government will actually go up, and that will help to offset the deficit spending. So if the economy grows its way out of recession, government receipts will go up, and then you can start paying off the debt. But the history shows, the data shows, that we never got to that part where we start paying off the debt. The economy has continued to grow at quite a clip, a fact that most of the supply side economists are proud of. But you see the national debt continuing to climb, and the idea of deficit spending sort of working its way into the political fabric. To the point where, we have this idea that it's a public debt. We owe it to ourselves. Therefore, we never have to pay it back. That becomes an operating principle of the economy at the same time that savings rates are dropping. Following the war, a lot of the borrowing that the federal government was doing was funded by high savings rates in the U.S. Now, more and more of that of the borrowing that the government does, almost 50% of it now, is funded by foreign central banks and foreign investors. So you have sort of opposite trends in place. You have a rising national debt and a rising amount of that funding coming from foreign players, which in and of itself is not a bad thing, but it does put future financial decisions in the hands of players that may or may not have our interests in mind when they go to make them.
We're talking about the debt that this country faces, the deficit this country faces right now, and as we approach a new era with Barack Obama about to become president of the United States, he faces huge challenges in terms of our economy, what to do about stimulating this economy, how is it done in the face of what we just learned is a $10 trillion debt, with businesses laying off people right and left, that the deficit rising continually, nobody's saving, the dollar doesn't buy what it did before. The question is, what do we do about it? Why is it there? We're going to talk about some of the things that are inside this book and the movie, IOUSA, which is now at the Charles Theater, that kind of delineates this in a very simple and very easy fashion to understand. We're here at the moment with Addison Wiggin, who is co-author of the book, IOUSA, and Kate Contrero, who is the co-author of the book as well. Addison is executive producer of the film and writer on the film. Kate is associate producer and also a writer on the film. She's managing editor of Daily Reckoning, and he is executive publisher of Agora Financial, and you are the ones who are in deficit along with the rest of us. So join us here at 410-319-8888. How do we get out of this? What do we do? Do we raise taxes? Do we cut Social Security? Do we privatize it, as some people wanted to do early on? Is that the wrong way to go? Do we have to control health care costs? Do we have to fuel this economy by building its infrastructure and putting people back to work? What do you think? At 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or how do we get into this mess in the first place? Let's talk a bit about how we got into this mess in the first place, from all the four places that your book and film talk about.
Well, I think that we effectively are victims of our own success. Most Americans, and I think the federal government mirrors this attitude, have factored risk out of their own lives. We have looked at various bubbles in the economy, like a rising stock market bubble in the late 90s, and then that mutating its way into a housing bubble. And we've effectively become addicted to these asset classes that are rising in value. And at different times, we think that they'll rise forever, and that it produces what most economists call the wealth effect. If you own a lot of stocks and the stocks look like they're going up forever, you offset your spending with this idea that, well, at least my stock portfolio is rising. The stock market kind of cracked in the tech wreck back in 2000, and there was a little road bump where people got a little bit nervous. Savings rates didn't begin to climb again, and then, you know, the Federal Reserve's response was to drop interest rates to a historic low 1% for a long period of time, and it mutated the stock market into a housing and consumption bubble. And then as housing prices began to rise, we saw the same effect, except that people were counting on the rising value of their homes. And up through even 2006 and well into 2007, people were counting on the rising value of their homes as their principal asset class, and the wealth effect was in full swing. It wasn't until, you know, the revelations at Bear Stearns in 2007 really started hitting the headlines that, you know, the fallacy of being able to continue your spending on one asset class rising after another really began to make itself clear, and consumers began to start questioning whether we could continue this indefinitely. And now I think we're in that situation. As we were making the film, the attitudes of just people that we were talking to, and even readers that would write back into us, has shifted dramatically. When we first started the film itself is actually inspired by a book that we published in 2005 called Empire of Debt, which looks at the rising level of debt in all levels of society. It looks at things like we were just talking about, the impact of supply-side economics in the Reagan era, and then continued in the Bush administration. And in 2005, it was kind of the height of the housing boom, and most people said, you guys are gloom and doomers. You don't know what you're talking about. This is the new era of American triumphalism. We got a lot of epithets hurled at us. But the book, the tone of the book was a forecast of what we were expecting might happen. And then as we began filming the documentary to get the ideas of the book out to a wider audience, we created the film as a forecast as well. But by 2007, by September of 2007, as we were preparing the film for submission to Sundance, a lot of the things that we had presented as a forecast were actually happening around us. The headlines revealed that, you know, the subprime mortgage bundles that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were very active in sponsoring weren't AAA by any means. And it was beginning to affect the balance sheets of Wall Street banks. I mean, that story is well known now, But at the time, most people didn't even know what
that, you're not putting all that at the doorstep of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are you?
Well, I think it was certainly enabled. I like to call them the world's greatest mortgage enablers.
Because, I mean, from the shows we've done and conversations we've had before, it seems as though that the banks we're talking about and Wall Street and the insurers like AIG were all wrapped up in this. And from all the articles we've been reading about Secretary Peterson and Bernanke, they weren't unaware this was about to happen. This is not something that just caught them by surprise when they woke up one morning. Oh, AIG's falling. That didn't happen. I mean, so
right. Well, it's worth pointing. Well, you know, certainly Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac weren't the only players, but they were among the largest, and they were also a government-sponsored entity, which allowed them to borrow at more preferable rates in the markets, and they helped to spur that bubble on. To the detriment of many people, you know, they had sort of a political mandate to help people get into homes, and I think they took that mandate a little bit too far.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Raise your questions and thoughts about why you think we're in this debt, and maybe have some answers here about what the history of this is, why we're here, and we're going to talk more in this program later. Our guests will stay here as we talk to Dean Baker, Stephen Shore, both economists, and Robert Bixby, who is executive director of the Concord Coalition, to have a little debate and discussion about why we're here and how to get out of it. 410-319-8888 is the number here now. Write to us here at steinershore@gmail.com as we talk with Addison Wiggin and Katie Contrero, who are co-authors of IOUSA, One Nation Under Stress and Debt, and are both producers and writers of the film IOUSA, which is now at the Charles Theater. 410-319-8888 and LaVon in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Mark, for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for all your panel. I agree with one of the panel speakers that said that we are modeling the same pattern of behavior, spending like the government. I mean, they've spent in excess and living way beyond the means. I think one of the areas that we need to look at, something that Barack Obama said that he was going to do, was line by line go in and see where we're wasting money. One of the things that areas I think that we should definitely look at is Medicaid. I mean, I hang with a lot of seniors. I'm not a senior myself, though, but
not yet.
Apparently, God will let me get there. But one of the things that I notice with them a lot is they get all this equipment that they use for maybe about a week or so, and then they don't use it anymore. And then the stuff sits idle, and nobody's using that. I think they should do a little bit more about transferring stuff that's not being used by some other people and giving it to somebody else, or stop that kind of access. As I think, and in other areas, you know, they look at that same thing. I think they definitely need to hire more auditors and accountants so that we can find out where this stuff is going and save some of this money. That's my comment. I'm hoping that they'll do something like that, but that's my comment.
LaVon, thank you so much for your call.
Well, we don't address the specifics of waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare program. We do talk about it in the attitude towards waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government in general. And that's really what we're trying to do in the film, is give people a broad understanding of what's happening. Medicare and Medicaid do present among the biggest challenge for the federal government as the baby boomers retire and people live longer and rely on the government more and more for healthcare. And that's one of the greatest challenges. And we actually do we kind of do back of the envelope math in the film, and we show that based on promises that are currently on the books, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid account for about $53 trillion that we would need now invested at Treasury rates just to cover those promises. And David Walker, who is one of the protagonists of the film and the former Comptroller General, is kind of famous in our circles for saying, how much of that money do we have invested right now? Zip. Zip. So we don't have any of that money invested at the moment, and yet that represents part of the biggest challenge of the finances of the government moving forward.
We have to give a very short break. Halim is our next caller up. Halim, if you can be patient and hold on, we'll come to your call when you hear what you have to say as well. We'll come back with Addison Wiggin and Katie Contrero. We'll be joined after this break by Dean Baker, Stephen Shore and Robert Bixby. So stay with us. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes. We have another piece of news for you, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We have a huge deficit facing the United States of America. It wasn't addressed much during this political campaign. It will be addressed now because President Barack Obama is going to have to face it. So is this new U.S. Congress. It'll be mostly Democratic on both the Senate and the House of Representatives side. And it'll be an issue to wrestle with. And as we learned earlier from our guest, Addison Wiggin and Kate E. Contreras, who wrote the book, IOUSA, One Nation Under Stress and Debt, and produced and wrote the film IOUSA, which is now at the Charles Theater, have said that we are in our debt is now $10 trillion as of September 30th, 2008. Joining us now is Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economics and Policy Research. Stephen Shore's in the studio, professor of economics from Johns Hopkins University. It's good to have you. Oh, and Bill Bixby's on the line as well. I mean, Robert Bixby, excuse me, to make it the actor. Robert Bixby, Bixby is executive director of the Concord Coalition, not a Hollywood actor. And Robert Bixby and Stephen Shore, Dean Baker, welcome. Good to have you all with us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for
being here. Dean, let me start with you if I might. Because I know you have a brief amount of time, and I want to just get into this whole issue of the huge debt we have to face and what we may do about it and where it might have come from. So, Dean, let me let you start.
Well, I actually think that the debt problem is often overstated. First off, we're going to have very large deficits over the next couple of years, but that's basically because we had a housing bubble that, unfortunately, people weren't paying attention to. You had a lot of people running around yelling about deficits 30, 40, 50 years out, and they ignored a $8 trillion housing bubble right in front of their face. That's now collapsed. It's thrown the economy into the worst recession probably since World War II. We will need very large deficits to keep the unemployment rate from getting into double-digit territory, and that's basically a good thing. Not that I want to see large deficits, but the alternative is really high unemployment. So given those options, I'll take large deficits every day of the week. Now, over the longer term, we do face a very, very serious deficit problem, but it's a healthcare problem. Our healthcare costs are hugely out of line with everyone else in the world. That's private sector health care costs. We spend approximately half of our health care is paid for through the government through programs like Medicare and Medicaid. So that creates a budget problem. But it's not really a budget problem. It's a health care problem. We have to fix our health care system. So if we don't fix our health care system, we're going to have enormous budget problems. But more importantly, we're going to have enormous economic problems because people aren't going to be able to afford health care. And insofar as they do pay for it, it's going to be an enormous burden on them. So I think a lot of this concern about the deficit is really misplaced.
Robert Bixby, let you jump in on that, if you would, and then we'll go back to our other guests, well, Addison Wiggin, Kate E. Contreras, and Stephen Shore.
I agree with a lot of that. The short-term budget deficit is going to be astronomical, but a lot of that comes from a slow economy and comes from having to deal with the financial crisis, because we've got, you know, short-term, we've got two problems. It's not just what looks like a severe recession, but a freezing of the credit markets. And so the government's trying to deal with both of those problems, and that is going to require, you know, money it already has, and so the deficit and the debt are going to go up in the short term. The issue of the long term is really what is the focus of the movie and what we've been talking about mostly. And you know, there you worry about structural trends. The short term, you know, deficits do come and go with the economy and with wars, and we're seeing both of that at work right now. It's really this long-term structural deficit that we need to be concerned about, because that's the unprecedented part of it. And a lot of that, as Dean says, does come from health care. I mean, I think you can call it a budget problem or you can call it a health care problem. They're clearly interrelated. And the sooner we get working on that, the better, but I know we're going to have to deal with this short-term problem first.
Let me turn for a second here to Addison Wiggin.
Well, I just wanted to point out, too, that Bob is, in fact, one of the protagonists of the film. He's been going around the country on what he calls a fiscal wake-up tour with David Walker, and they've been pointing out and discussing health care, among other things, also the Social Security program, and Bob is referring to as a structural approach to the finances of the country, and that makes up a big part of it's a road picture of sorts as we follow them around and get people's responses to both what we end up calling the Mount Rushmore crowd of the American economic scene, and also just the general public's opinion about what's happening and their impressions about our ability to deal with these impending challenges.
Now, I want to throw something out to the five of you who are here, a large crew for a small radio show, but let's try to do this. And then we will get to Halim and Albert, our first two callers, our next two callers up. We know these deficits are facing us, and they're huge. We have this fiscal crisis facing America at the same time. There's all these questions about the bailout. Now, Secretary Paulson has said that they're going to give more money to AIG. There are people arguing there's not enough transparency in what they're doing with AIG and how that money's being spent. And that'll be a topic for another show. But so my question is, we know it's here. We know that we've been not saving, that we're spending too much money and not bringing in enough. That means that, and if it was our homes, we'd be losing our homes and we'd all be in bankruptcy court if there really was such a thing anymore in America. And so the question is, what do we do? How do we address? And I know the film that you all did doesn't kind of talk about how to fix it, but the question is, we have to wrestle with how we fix it. So how do we fix it? Let me go to Robert Bixby, and then we'll go to Dean Baker, Stephen Shore, and to our other guests here, Addison and Kate. Dean, let's talk about how we fix the issue we're facing.
Did you want me to speak or Bob first?
I'm going to go to Dean, then Bob.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Well, as I say, I really think the healthcare system is front and center, and, you know, I'm really hoping that, President-elect Obama really puts it at the top of his agenda, because...
Well, what does that mean to you, Dean? How do we, when you talk about fixing it, and I've read a bunch of the articles you've written, I've read your book, the Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, which I enjoyed a great deal. But the question is, how do we fix where we are now? What are the steps you take to deal with this healthcare system?
Well, you know, President-elect Obama had, the workings of, I think, a very good plan. He took it from Jacob Hacker, a political scientist at Berkeley University, where he proposes setting up a public sector plan that people could, public sector healthcare plan along the lines of the Medicare system that people have the option to buy into. You'd require all employers to either insure their workers or to pay a fee that will help support insurance for, you know, people that aren't covered at their workplace. And then they'll have a system of subsidies. Now, what's key to the story, on the one hand, we want to provide health care for everyone. That's something we've been negligent on, remiss on. Every other country does that, every other wealthy country. But the other point is that we have to begin to squeeze costs. We waste a huge amount of money in our insurance system. Somewhere around 30% of healthcare costs simply go to administration, which is just incredible waste, shuffling papers back and forth. We pay way more on prescription drugs than anyone does anywhere else in the world. We pay our doctors, particularly the specialist, cardiologist, neurosurgeons, the highly paid specialists, way more than anyone does anywhere else in the world. We have to squeeze those costs. So this is going to be a long-term process, but there's no reason on earth we should be paying twice as much for health care per person as they do in Germany, France, Canada. We don't pay twice as much for our cars, for our computers, for anything else. Why should we do it for our health care?
Robert Bixby?
I think twofold. On Medicare or health care more broadly, we do need to make some link between expanded coverage and controlling costs. And controlling costs is really important, because if we have Medicare for all or any sort of expansion without controlling costs, we just make an unsustainable situation even more unsustainable, if that's possible. So I would agree. On the cost control, I would look at overutilization as one of the problems as well. You know, we tend to... medicine can do a lot for a lot of people, and we don't have very good evidence on what treatments work and what don't work. So there's an awful lot of waste, not just in terms of administrative costs that Dean mentioned, but just in terms of a lot of health care that is consumed without any incremental added benefit. And we're going to have to do a better job. If we're going to expand coverage, we're going to have to get better value for the dollar. So I think that one reason to have the federal government lead through the Medicare and Medicaid programs is that they can collect the evidence and they can collect the data and they can set the standards that would help reduce costs in the healthcare system more broadly. I would also do something with Social Security, just because that program is out of balance over the long term. It's very easy to fix. It's not easy politically, but it's a lot easier to tackle than the health care programs. So I think that that they should not leave that out of the equation as well. Those are the two programs. And then, you know, we're going to have to look at revenues. I think we're going to have to squeeze all we can out of spending, but I don't think we can keep revenues where they are have been historically, because with the aging population and rising health care costs, it's unrealistic to think that you're going to be able to do it all on the revenue side. I mean, on the spending side.
Of course, if we hadn't borrowed so much from Social Security surplus fund, Social Security might not be in the state it's in now, but
it would be the same.
So
cash in, cash out, it would be the same.
I think everything that people have said makes a lot of sense, but I don't think it's the complete picture. So far, most of the discussion of late has really been about the government side. But I think it's important to remember that there's really a huge lack of savings at the corporate sector and the individual sector. Given the current government situation, we're looking at big short-term deficits, but hopefully in the long term we can have a system where people are saving more. But there are some excellent, new, interesting programs that are being developed that are geared towards helping people save more tomorrow. We don't want people to be saving a lot now because we want to stimulate the economy, but longer term, we need to get back to some sort of more stable situation. So the one I want to mention is Dick Thaler and Shlomo Benarti have a program called Save More Tomorrow, where people commit themselves to save more of their future raises. So we need a system where increasingly we get people to tie their own hands, because people, I think, want to be saving. But, you know, with all the credit cards and options they have for spending, sometimes that can be a tough thing to do. Healthcare is really a key issue, but there's also this individual side and the corporate side where there's a lot of debt also.
And before we turn to our guest who've been here since the beginning, let me give a final thought to Dean Baker, then we'll open the phones because, Dean, I know you have to leave.
Yeah, well, I think the point about savings, you know, I've actually worked on how we can improve people's savings. But one of the things to keep in mind is the reason people haven't been saving is because we had asset bubbles, first in the stock market and then in the housing market. There's well documented, it's like one of the most basic economic propositions. When people have wealth, even if it's fictional because of the bubble, they're going to save less. They consume based on it. So the fact that people were saving so little over the last few years, that was exactly what you expect when you have an $8 trillion housing bubble. So I was out there jumping up and down.
Yes, you were.
Yelling, we had a real big housing bubble, and one of the problems with that is people don't save. I wish we had more people saying that.
And related things, it's exactly what we'd expect for the corporate sector to be in so much debt, given that we give tax subsidies to issuing debt while not to issuing equity. So we're really encouraging corporations to do the same things.
Yeah, the two things play on each other. You have public dis-savings by running huge deficits in the public and the private sector not saving people, not saving for reasons like a housing bubble or whatever. And those two things combine to really deprive the future of the savings we need to grow the economy.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economics and Policy Research, I know you have to run, and thank you so much for taking the time at the last minute for us. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Take care. Appreciate it being here. Let's go right to the phones. We might get our listeners in at 410-319-8888. Very patient listeners. Halim in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, how y'all doing?
Good, Halim. Very well.
Okay. You know, when I hear people suggest that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is at the root of the financial problem, it's like saying that the noble quest to have more poor people own homes is a journey or a quest that we shouldn't even try to pursue, when the reality, from my perspective, is not that poor people were given loans, it's the type of loans that they were given. So, you know, if you're going to loan money to poor people, why would you give them adjustable rates where you don't know what the amount that they're going to be paying, as opposed to giving them a fixed rate where you know exactly and they know exactly what they're going to pay?
That is part of the banking system, people said, needs to be more controlled, and that which has not been controlled. Addison or Kate, whoever wants to grab that.
Well, I think that your point is well taken, it's not necessary to single out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but they were among the largest players in effectively guaranteeing that those adjustable rates would adjustable rate mortgages wouldn't sit on the balance sheets of local and regional banks, the ones that were actually creating those mortgages. So the way the program was set up, if you went to your local bank and got an adjustable rate mortgage, it was easy for that bank to sell it on to Fannie Mae, who was then bundling them up and slapping on a AAA rating and selling them off into pension funds and whatnot. And it became a matter of the local banks trying to originate as many mortgages as possible because they knew they didn't have to carry the risk of that mortgage. At the same time, they would get a fee for producing it. So it became, the term in the campaign that was thrown around a lot was predatory lending. It became part of business as usual for local and regional banks to produce as many mortgages as possible. And the situation that you're describing just became part of the banking system as it existed during the housing bubble.
And, I mean, again, I have to go back to some of the arguments about the root of this. I mean, the root of it, I mean, it started with Lyndon Baines Johnson in 1968 when they started changing the whole nature of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. To pay for the war in Vietnam. That was one of the things they did, and it just began to unravel. It really began to unravel in the 1980s and 90s under Reagan, Bush, Carter, Clinton, I should say.
You know, there's a funny, the funniest scene in IOUSA has a Steve Martin skit, but I mean the whole
That's a very great skit. I love that part
of it. It's yes. Just, around this, fictional book called Don't Buy Stuff You Can't Afford.
Right.
And if we just sort of got back to that, it's great to have low interest loans for low income people, but I mean and encouraging home ownership is a good thing, but no matter what we do in the private or public sector, it would be good to remember those famous words: don't buy stuff you can't afford.
If I could follow on that,
Stephen Shore,
I respect a lot what the caller is saying. I think it's important that we realize that home ownership by and of itself is not just a plain and simple moral good. When people face a lot of income risk, locking themselves into fixed mortgage payments can be a very dangerous thing. Increasingly, people's consumption comes in the form of what we typically call consumption commitments, things they're stuck with, like car payments, house payments, and that sort of thing. And for those folks with stable incomes, rich or poor, that's great. If you don't plan on moving, if your income is stable, that's wonderful. But for people whose incomes are unstable, who are planning on moving, homeownership can be enormously expensive. And we really don't want to be encouraging everyone to be a homeowner.
And that wouldn't be such an issue also if we weren't doing what we did to people to encourage them to buy houses they shouldn't have bought and probably couldn't have gotten the loans, shouldn't have gotten the loans in the first place. And if there was a housing stock that people rented that they felt comfortable in, they wouldn't be desperate to go out and try to buy a place. That's part of what fuels
absolutely
that
discussion. In Europe, they have lots of long-term lenders, renters, and it works fine.
410-319-8888, Albert in Parkville, you're on the air.
I want to mention something. Good evening.
Good evening.
All your panel there. I want to mention something that you've overlooked, you've ignored. I think that we've ignored the fact that the Bush administration had not really come forward on the cost of the wars that's being conducted, $10 billion a year, $10 billion a month, and tried to encourage the American people to do guns and butter at the same time. And World War II wasn't done like that. There were all sorts of controls to curb civilian spending to support the war effort. And this has not been done, has not even been considered. And all of President Bush's requests for additional funding came after the budget had been submitted. And he didn't want the fact publicized that, hey, look, this is coming out of our hide. We are having guns and butter, unfettered spending, while we are trying to support two war fronts. And this is coming back to haunt us. I think that at the point that we solve all of that problem and solve the problem of the financial crisis, I think that the United States should really consider a Marshall Plan for the United States so we can be competitive again on the world stage. After World War II, everybody that we bombed into destruction, into submission, we rebuilt our industries. And now they are more modern than we are, and we can't compete with them. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Albert. Let's talk a little bit about the film that you put out, whoever wants to again go, either Addison or Kate, and then go to Robert, downplays the cost of the war a lot. I mean, it doesn't really focus on the cost of the war, not downplays. It doesn't focus on the cost of the war a great deal.
Well, we did that in a way on purpose because for the most part, whenever we talk to somebody, they immediately assume that the war was the problem. So when you ask somebody, or tell them that the federal budget is spending or federal government is spending more than they take in, they say, well, of course, we're fighting this war. And that perception, if you look at the numbers, is incorrect. If you did away with the spending on both Afghanistan and Iraq, for example, it only represents about 3% of the financial challenge of funding Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Let me ask you a quick book, and Rob Despy, please feel free to jump in as well as Katie Contreras on this and Stephen as well. But let me just push you on that a little bit. I mean, with what was said here. I mean, if other economists, Joseph Stiglitz being one, will argue that the cost of $12 billion a month for the cost of the war in Iraq itself without Afghanistan is not even touching the real cost of the war. That if you add in all the costs of refurbishing equipment and everything else, you're talking about $1.5 trillion at least, if you can't count in the cost of the war when it costs to the mental health and medical care of soldiers coming home. Their argument in their book was, when we interviewed them, was that the final cost of this war you're going to see is close to $3 trillion, not the 3% that some people are arguing that it is, that the case that you're making.
Well, we're,
I think the 3%, the $3 trillion, though, is a net present value cost of the war. And, for example, the $53 trillion that is talked about in the movie is a net present cost of the unfunded obligations that we now face. So it is a, even if you look at it in those terms, still a fairly small percentage. But let me make another point here. The point is that the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, which are right now 42% of the budget, those programs are running on autopilot. That is, you know, Congress doesn't approve a specific amount of money each year. It just you know it's run on a formula. And it's those programs are the ones that are projected to grow the most because of the aging of the population and the rising health care costs. So there's a big bow wave, you might say, of spending with these programs. Whereas with defense, while we're spending a lot right now and a lot on the war, it's not something that is projected to grow and grow and grow forever faster than the economy. So it's more of a fixed cost than the entitlement programs, and that's something new. That's something different. That was the point that we were trying to get across in the movie. It wasn't to downplay the war, to let defense off the hook, so to speak, for budget cuts, but simply to try to highlight that there's a new dynamic in place here that we really need to worry about.
Right, and to avoid the difficulty of if, for example, Obama is successful at bringing troops home quicker than on a quicker time frame than the Bush administration might have, the outlying fiscal problem that we face still exists, and we wanted to make sure that was part of the conversation, so that if the war on terror comes to an end, people realize that we still have a significant challenge on our hands.
We're talking about the huge debt America faces, $10 trillion as of September the 30th, 2008, even before the election was done and before before there is a President Barack Obama. Addison Wiggin, you just heard, co-author of the book, IUSA, One Nation, Distress and Debt. His co-author is here, Kate Contreras. They put out the film IOUSA, which was at Sundance, and is now at the Charles Theater. And we're also joined by Robert Bixby, who is one of the protagonists in this film, and he is executive director of the Concord Coalition that has been traveling the country trying to talk about the debt and make people understand the fiscal crisis that we're facing. And Stephen Shore is with us. Dr. Shore is a professor of economics at Johns Hopkins University, and you're with us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, and Ron, a very patient Ron, you're on the air.
In discussions like this, people always talk about the annual deficit and the national debt and Medicare and Social Security. Nobody ever talks about the interest that we pay on our national debt. This fiscal 2008, it was about $411. The previous year, it was about $407 billion. The year before that, it was more than $400 billion and so forth. I can't imagine what future interest payments are going to cost us. In fiscal 2008, the cost of the interest was about $34 billion a month,
mm-hmm.
which is three times the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, hundreds of billions of dollars of that goes offshore. It doesn't go to American citizens. And for that, what we get is not much. It's very unproductive.
Well, and you raise some really important issues. And let me just say that Addison Wiggin and Kate E. Contrera in their book do raise this issue. Either one of you all want to jump into that, please do. Go right ahead.
Well, we do. I think you'll enjoy the film then, because we point out among, you know, we talk a lot about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, but we also identify the rising debt load, the rising interest on the debt, as one of the challenges that we face. Because moving forward, as more baby boomers retire and the costs for health care and for Social Security rise, they in and of themselves and also the rising debt eat up more of the annual budget in mandatory spending and leave less and less and less to discretionary spending, which is the spending that the government does to carry on its day-to-day activities. And we actually project forward how, you know, at what rate they're going to have to start dropping programs in order to keep up with rising healthcare costs, retirement costs, and rising debt loads. It really, a simple way of looking at it is the U.S. government right now holds the largest adjustable mortgage in the history of mankind, and we're all sitting on it, and we're all facing it at the same time.
Another way of looking at it is that interest on the debt is our largest foreign aid program.
It is. That's the next point I want to get.
No question. As the caller said, interest on the debt, a lot of it's going overseas now because we're borrowing so much from abroad. That's a real problem, and if the caller had come to a fiscal wake-up tour event, he would hear me mention that, because I always do the lead-off, and one of the points that I make is that the net interest cost is a huge part of the federal budget, and bigger than the war cost, bigger than the federal government's contribution to Medicaid, and that's one of the consequences of running deficits is, of course, you run big debts, and that's sort of the credit card connection that people can understand. If they try to live off their credit cards, they run up big interest costs, and we try to point out that the federal government has the same problem.
You were going to say something, because I do want to get to who owns our debt, which is really...
The caller talked about $400 billion as if it's a small number, but the government pays a very low interest rate compared to other countries and based on historical norms. And as these folks have said, this is an adjustable rate mortgage. There's no reason why that number couldn't get dramatically bigger as our interest rate goes up. Given the size of the deficits we're running, we're asking other countries to shoulder larger and larger burden, and they may demand higher and higher interest rates for doing so.
No,
yeah, this is like a teaser rate.
One of the things that came out in the film, we only have like a minute and a half minute left here when I get to, is who owns our debt? That's the huge piece of the issue that we have to really be concerned about in this world, I think.
Well, right now the largest purchasers, the largest consumers of our debt are China, Japan, and the oil exporting countries.
Saudi Arabia. The Emirates.
Right.
Right.
And they, you know, that's the result of the economic balance that we have between our countries and theirs. But it's growing, and it puts our debt in their hands.
Addison Wiggin, Kate Contreras, thank you both so much for being here. CIO USA at the Charles Theater. Stephen Shore and Robert Bixby, thank you so much for taking your time. It's been a pleasure to have you all with us.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips, engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Voice, Stavros Halkias, and Charles Harris. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. If you hear this show again and podcast our past shows and additional interviews, go to steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care and watch your pocketbook.